Hello and welcome to CIA Files, True Stories of U.S. Intelligence. I'm your host, Topher M. Ford. With me is my co-host, Brandon Givens. Brandon, I have no idea why I'm talking so fast.
Oh, well, you know, it's like kind of back in the earlier news, Walter Cronkite time, maybe a bit before.
Cronkite talked slow, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. That's what made him so special. But everyone else. Up next,
you mentioned
a lot of information in.
You mentioned the exception to the rule to highlight the rule. I see. You're playing some 4D chess there, Mr. Givens.
I assure you it was purely accidental.
All right. Well, today we are going to take a look at our current CIA director, William J. Burns. We're not giving him the full CIA files proper treatment just yet. I feel like it's a little too early to do that. Have to see how the rest of his tenure plays out. But in the meantime, it seems like a good idea to at least know who he is, since he's running the agency right now.
And will he burn it down?
I'm guessing no, because he seems like a relatively mild-mannered character compared to, you know, especially the last couple of directors.
As you name the ship, so it sails.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about. So this is an interesting thing, just a thing to talk about before we get into Burns. What we're going to learn is that Bill Burns is a career diplomat, and his father was a career military man. He was a general and then an ambassador. It kind of, you know, like it runs in the family. It almost seems like a legacy sort of thing. And it reminded me a little bit of, you know, the previous administration under Trump. They talked a lot about the deep state. And I don't know, to me, it kind of seems like if there was a deep state, which, I mean, I guess there is, depending on how you define it, then Bill Burns would probably be in it like grandfather did. So I wanted to talk a little bit first about this concept of a deep state. So I've got a quote here from Business Insider. This is a quote actually from one of Trump's public relations figures, Mr. Sean Spicer, if you remember him.
Spicy.
Yeah, that SNL, that was one of the best bits on SNL. So this is from Business Insider quoting one of his PR meetings. A reporter asked him, "Does the government believe that there is such a thing as a deep state that is actively working to undermine the president?" Spicer replied, quote, "I think that there's no question when you have 8 years of one party in office that there are people who stay in government, affiliated with, joined, and continue to espouse the agenda of the previous administration. So I don't think it should come to any surprise that there are people that burrowed into government during the 8 years of the last administration and may have believed in that agenda and want to continue to seek it." Actually, Sean Spicer's response there is a relatively mild take on how Trump and his supporting media portrayed this deep state as like the shadowy cabal that was working to undermine his government at every opportunity.
Well, then, yeah, I would say, like, I told It was like, I agree with Sean Spicer. That's obviously what's going to happen. It's what you would expect, especially if you don't fire people from the previous administration, which would just be absolutely corrupt. But anyone who was hired, I mean, there are appointee positions, and then there are, you know, like more career-based positions. And so, yeah, he's kind of right. And so people will say, so you admit there is a deep state.
Yes. Well, so the original concept of the deep state, according to the things that I looked up that I can't find the link of now, but the concept of a deep state originated in Turkey and in surrounding areas. And it was basically a reference to corrupt officials and criminals running the government, that they had overtaken the government and they were using it to enrich themselves.
There's a word for that in political science. We say the state is captured when a small group can stop the government from doing something. Like if the people want something done, or the representatives want something done, which those two things don't always align, but neither can get their way because a small group has the ability to stop it, then the state is considered to be captured.
Okay. So
there's an argument that the U.S. is captured.
I imagine there's always been an argument for that. Okay, so we've got that argument, that definition of deep state, a captured government. It made me think of Russia immediately after the fall of communism and how the Russian organized criminals sort of swooped in, and when all of the state-held resources were privatized, they swooped in and bought them, you know, for pennies on the dollar, so to speak. I don't know what the Russian equivalent of that would be. But so, yeah. Then there is this, the way Trump constantly referred to it and made it seem like this other definition of, like I mentioned before, a shadowy conspiratorial group working to undermine the president. He really made it sound like, you know, very similar to the concept of like a new world order.
Well, Illuminati. It's just a different, it's just a rebranding of the Illuminati.
Right.
It's like, oh, exactly. Illuminati sounds too hocus pocus. It sounds too, you know, satanic. And we want to keep our, it's also played out in very 90s.
Right.
So
you got to do a little rebranding. But Trump basically used it as an excuse every time he couldn't get his way. You know, if like with the Muslim ban, he tried to do that. The courts didn't uphold that. That was the deep state, you know, and just
checks and balances. Checks and balances in our constitutional government, as written and designed by the founders.
Even if his efforts were, shot down by judges that he appointed, still deep state. And then there's this other notion of the deep state that I have heard. So some of you listeners are probably familiar with podcaster Dan Carlin, Hardcore History, and his podcast that he hasn't put out in a while called Common Sense, where he talked about current events. But he talked about going to some conventions and meeting with some, you know, like career military men who'd been in the military, whatever, armed forces, for their entire lives. You know, they joined up at when they were 18. Now they're like in their 50s, 60s, still in the military, in higher positions. And then you have the same thing with government officials who were appointed or hired. They weren't elected. And they've just been working in public service, or the, you know, foreign office, State Department, things like that. But they've been there pretty much their entire career. And this to me is like the real deep state, I guess the term deep state doesn't even really apply, but that's, you know, what I kept thinking about when Trump would mention the deep state, and that there's no conspiratorial connection there. It's just, you know, this collection of career military and public works people, which is kind of where I, you know, Bill Burns falls, and we'll get into that here in a bit, but I just wanted to have a little bit of a discussion. It seems like a good place to, mention.
Well, you have in the State Department, well, not all ambassadorships are appointed, but many are. And it's become something that can be like a prize, like, oh, you raised a lot of money for me, so you get to be the ambassador to Singapore. But then some of them are like, well, you know, whoever goes to Russia and China, that, you know, often someone with some State Department influence, former senator or something. But most ambassador positions really are career state service employees. But whether it's an appointed position or not, there's always someone there that's been there. You know, that's a career State Department employee.
Right. And those are the people that I'm kind of referring to. Maybe they're not the ambassadors. You know, maybe the people at the very top have a higher turnover rate. But there are always going to be people who have been there the whole time, you know, that aren't necessarily, they weren't appointed. They were hired on, and they've made themselves indispensable, you know.
Yeah, they're good at their jobs. They've been around a while. Right. They're good. Yeah,
they know where everything is. They know where where to find the sawdust for the vomit, and, you know, how to find the expensive champagne that this, you know, that this foreign leader really likes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, what you're kind of doing is you're finding something that's completely innocent and connecting it to this deep, dark conspiracy label, because it's actually good that you have people that aren't fired anytime a new political party comes into power. Right. You know, so you've got career policy.
That you've got people who've dedicated their lives to working in these positions, and they don't have a shadowy agenda. They're just doing their job. All right. Well, I guess having said that, let's talk about old Bill Burns. So William Joseph Burns was born on April 4th, 1954 at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to Peggy Cassaday and William F. Burns. So his father was Oxford educated and a major general in the Army. He served as the director of the United States Armed Control and Disarmament Agency under President Ronald Reagan. He worked to negotiate nuclear disarmament agreements with former Soviet states, and he worked toward the same ends under President George H.W. Bush for the Nunn-Lugar Act. So William Burns' dad was
a hippie.
Although he was he worked hard. Yeah, well, as far as like the nuclear thing goes, yeah, he spent most of his like the back half of his life working to try to reduce nuclear arms among, you know, a lot of the world powers. Which is something that his son, you know, picked up the torch on. And his dad, this is from his obituary, his dad's obituary. His dad died in 2021 at 88 years old. This is from his obituary at legacy.com. Quote, "He was a devoutly religious person, eager to help anyone who required it. He had a wonderful, dry sense of humor and enjoyed making all around him laugh. He was full of stories, some of which even had a grain of truth. He was the he was the patriarch and always there for his extended family." So, I mean, and you know, and that's an obituary. So
that's cute. Yeah, that's sweet.
But, you know, given that this is, I guess, kind of a quick and dirty episode as opposed to a deep dive, I didn't have time to find like really good sources to give some granular detail on his father's life or even his early life. I don't know that it's out there yet. Anyway, I'm sure at some point his life will be dissected and we'll get a book about it. But so yeah, for right now, it's just the main stuff we know is his dad, William F. Burns, worked his way up to major general. Then he retired from the military and basically became a diplomat, trying to broker nuclear non-proliferation agreements, especially with the former Soviet states at, you know, during and after, immediately after the fall of the Soviet Union. So I think that's a good work. I mean, at least on the surface, it sounds like he was doing good work.
Yeah. Maybe he's reduced the number of his work, helped reduce the number of nuclear missiles that we will be able to survive nuclear holocaust.
Yeah. All right. So as far as Bill Burns, the son, like I said, I couldn't find anything on his childhood, but he was born on a military base, the Fort Bragg, and raised by a military father. So that tells you a little bit, anyway, about his childhood. Here's from state.gov as far as like his collegiate career. Quote, "Ambassador Burns earned a BA in history from La Salle University and MPhil and DPhil, or those are PhDs, I'm assuming.
Master of Philosophy.
MPhil and DPhil degrees in international relations from Oxford University, where he studied as a Marshall Scholar. He is the recipient of 3 honorary doctoral degrees. So just like his father, Oxford educated, he's also a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And so he and his dad remind me of,
and this isn't,
well, in a way, yeah, but further than that, it reminds me of the like the political leaders from the 50s and 60s, especially the Republicans. Not that I don't know that they were, you know, aligned with Republican and or Democrat, because Bill Burns served under Republican and Democratic presidents. But you know, the elite upper class educated men who were smarter than everyone else, and so they, you know, knew they were fit to lead, and that, you know, and these were like the kind of people who were running, especially the Republican Party, until it was sort of co-opted by populist leaders. This is from state.gov, what it a little more insight into Bill Burns. Quote, "Ambassador Burns is the author of Economic Aid and American Policy Toward Egypt, 1955 to 1981. He speaks Russian, Arabic, and French, and is the recipient of 2 Presidential Distinguished Service Awards and a number of Department of State Awards, including 2 Distinguished Honor Awards, the 2006 Charles E. Cobb Jr. Ambassadorial Award for Initiative and Success in Trade Development, the 2005 Robert C. Fraser Memorial Award for Conflict Resolution and Peacemaking, and the James Clement Dunn Award. In 1994, he was named to Time Magazine's list of the 50 most promising American leaders under age 40 and to Time's list of 100 young global leaders. So, you know, he came out swinging, you know, after college, and
yeah,
showed a lot of promise.
Yeah, of course, I mean, the fact that, yeah, he's ambassador to of Russia and Jordan, legacy, yeah.
Right.
Pretty impressive.
So he started his career with the Foreign Service. He served as an executive secretary from January 96 to February of 98. He was then this is the first time I've seen like the full title of an ambassador. He was made ambassador extraordinary and plenipotentiary to Jordan, where he served from 1998 to June 2001. That's a long title.
Yep. It sounds very, very kind of British sounding, but they have different titles.
Right. But this shows, you know, what we were talking about, serving under, like, no matter who the person in charge is, you know, staying sort of apolitical, I guess. I don't know. Well, that's probably the wrong word, but.
They're apartisan. they're supposed to be apartisan. Yeah, nonpartisan. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So he served as the ambassador to Jordan from 1998 to June 2001. So that would have been under Bill Clinton. I don't know that he was. Well, yeah. And then from 2001 to 2005, he served as Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. And then from 2005 to 2008, he was the ambassador to Russia. And in 2008, he was made a quote-unquote career ambassador. And I'm not sure exactly what that title means, but it sounds like...
Well, my understanding is, they get appointed and transferred, but it's kind of like the top person at the embassy.
Yeah, I was promotion.
That's understood,
So under George W. Bush, you know, he served as Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, and then as ambassador to Russia. And then from 2008 to 2011, he served as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. And then finally, he served as Deputy Secretary of State from July 2001 to November 2014. I'm sorry, July 2011 to November 2014. After that, he retired from the Foreign Service. And he, you know, that last bit, he served at some point in there. He also served as like acting Secretary of State while Hillary Clinton went through her appointment process. So he sounds like a very highly trusted individual in his position. So maybe a kind of a safe appointment to the CIA director. I guess we should take a look at some of the, you know, the political situations that he was working in. So he served as his first ambassadorship was to Jordan from 98 to 2001. We're just going to hit a few of the highlights of his career as an ambassador. He's, you know, from 2005 to 2008, he was the ambassador to Russia under W. And W's relationship to Russia was a little I don't, would you call it hostile?
I don't know. I mean, he seemed to have a crush on Putin, seeing his cross and everything, but it was still at the time when the Republicans didn't like the Russians. So it was still in the way back where they saw them as a bit of a threat. This is much more hostile under Obama. They really didn't like Hillary and Obama. Yeah. I mean, it's so hard to say when it's like how the relations are, because even when they're kind of friendly, it's frenemy.
You know, I think the general like view in retrospect anyway is that President Bush W was tough on Russia, and that may have been mostly like a rhetoric thing, that his talk was tough on Russia. And then Obama took over, and initially when Obama first took office, he called for a full reset on relations with Russia. George W. had pushed for NATO expansion in the area, but Obama tried to work with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev to reduce nuclear arsenals, and the two leaders signed the New START Treaty in 2010. And if you remember, Dmitry Medvedev was Putin's sort of stand-in president, because the Constitution didn't allow him to have it. It limited the consecutive number of terms you can serve as president. So Medvedev was basically appointed by Putin, and then Putin served as prime minister and sort of ran things, you know, backseat driver situation.
Right.
But it does seem like at the beginning, when Medvedev was in office, that Obama was trying to rebuild relations with Russia. But when Putin reclaimed the office of president in 2012, those U.S.-Russia relationships backslid. Another big thing that that Bill Burns is credited with playing a major role in was the Iran nuclear deal, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The agreement stated that severe sanctions on Iran would be lifted in exchange for the dismantling of Iran's nuclear development programs and for giving official inspectors access to the process. I've got a big chunk of text here from the website for the Council on Foreign Affairs that gives us some more detail. Quote, Iran agreed not to produce either the highly enriched uranium or the plutonium that could be used in a nuclear weapon. It also took steps to ensure that its Fordo, Natanz, and Erik facilities pursued only civilian work, including medical and industrial research. Iran agreed to eventually implement a protocol that would allow inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency, the United Nations nuclear watchdog, unfettered access to its nuclear facilities and potentially to undeclared sites. Inspections are intended to guard against the possibility that Iran could develop nuclear arms in secret, as it has allegedly attempted before. The EU, United Nations, and United States all committed to lifting their nuclear-related sanctions on Iran. However, many other U.S. sanctions on Iran, some dating back to the 1979 hostage crisis, remained in effect. They cover matters such as Iran's ballistic military program, support for terrorist groups, and human rights abuses. Though the United States committed to lifting its sanctions on oil exports, it kept restrictions on financial transactions, which have deterred international trade with Iran. The parties agreed to lift an existing UN ban on Iran's transfer of conventional weapons and ballistic missiles after 5 years, if the IAEA certifies that Iran is only engaged in civilian nuclear activity. So that was the bones of the nuclear deal that was worked out with Iran under Obama. And Bill Burns is credited with, being the main facilitator of this by working his back channels, talking to the, all the people who know the people, and, making this happen. And I guess there's been a lot of debate as to whether or not the deal was a good deal.
I think that debate depends on, whether or not you like Obama. I mean, most of the complaints I've heard about it, they're not based in much reality. It's, we should have held out for a better deal, or we should have shaken our fist a little bit more, and just because it happened during the Obama administration, it had to be awful. It had to be showing weakness or something.
Right, finding things to nitpick, because the complaints against it, the criticisms against it, reminded me of the criticisms that the military and CIA figures had with Kennedy over the Cuban Missile Crisis. If you remember,
you're being Kennedy weak.
Worked out with. Yeah, Kennedy was like, our situation is our enemy has nuclear missiles, right off our coasts, and we want them to get rid of them. So let's, and then he worked that out with Khrushchev. They worked it out and got, took care of that, got the missiles out of there. And all of his critics were like, you shouldn't have just got him to get rid of the missiles. You should have gotten him to do all of this other stuff. And Kennedy was like, that wasn't realistic. We couldn't, and trying to like strong arm him into, capitulating to all of our demands was not realistic. We had a major crisis that needed handling, and we could circle back to the other stuff later. But, this is what needs taken care of now.
They were also mad because the U.S., or part of the deal was, I think we were not going to pull our missiles out of Turkey or not put them there in Italy. And then they're like, that's hurting our defense now. It's like, it seems to be a fairly even trade. But I think those guys, they just weren't worried that, even if the nuclear missiles were fired, they were like, we'll survive it. It's not really going to be the end of the world. And I mean, that was their attitude. And not for us. And I mean, they, in some respects, they may have been right as far as like, like nuclear winter and all that. A lot of those were horror story boogaboos. But at the same time, if it lands on New York City, millions of people are going to die. And they're like, we'll win the war.
Right. Because they were completely swept up in the means justify the ends, or the ends, ends justify the means. And I think the critics of the Iran nuclear deal, the ends for them are just to make Obama into a villain every step of the way. So, so what happened after that? The agreement was supposed to start, toward the beginning of, start in early 2016. So here's some more from the Council on Foreign Affairs website. Quote, the agreement got off to a fairly smooth start. The IAEA certified in early 2016 that Iran had met its preliminary pledges, and the United States, European Union, and United Nations responded by repealing or suspending their sanctions. Most significantly, U.S. President Barack Obama's administration dropped secondary sanctions on the oil sector, which allowed Iran to ramp up its oil exports to nearly the level it was prior to sanctions. The United Nations and many European nations also unfroze about $100 billion worth of frozen Iranian assets. However, the deal has been near collapse since President Trump withdrew the United States from it in 2018 and reinstated devastating banking and oil sanctions. Trump said the agreement failed to address Iran's ballistic missile program and its proxy warfare in the region, and he claimed that the sunset provisions would enable Iran to pursue nuclear weapons in the future. So,
well, if you can't fix all the problems at once, you shouldn't fix any of the problems. You gotta fix all the problems. Not just a couple of them. So we've got to redo the treaty. But now, how many problems are being fixed?
It's really turned around. Yeah. Of course, what else did Trump do with Iran? He assassinated one of their major leaders.
Yeah, and I don't know really what good effects that had. I'm not necessarily crying that fellow was killed or not. It just, if you're trying, well, you know, this whole thing about being harsh, if you just are harsh, then, oh, they'll want to negotiate, and it doesn't quite work that way. But at the same time, offering up flowers doesn't really work either. Like, Obrador in Mexico, he's like, oh, we're not going to go really hard after the drug cartels. We're going to try to relax, and violence has gone up. And it's like,
right. When you think from a diplomatic standpoint, so just to clarify, because we didn't state initially what we're talking about, this is the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Major General Qasem Soleimani, and Trump had him blown up with a missile.
It's at the airport of Iraq, in Iraq. That was my big problem with it, is it was, yeah, it was like at the Baghdad airport. It was at the, yeah, it was like at the airport in Iraq, like. So we bombed our ally, and that was my big problem. I mean, like, taking the guy out necessarily, like, you know, if you're going to be working in a covert organization, then your enemy state may take you out. But it was at the airport of a neutral state, essentially a neutral state. And like,
but also from a diplomatic point of view, What was the benefit of it? I mean, I understand there's these moral arguments about whether or not Soleimani deserved to be assassinated, but what is the diplomatic benefit of killing him? And yeah, what it seemed to me, and again, I've said this, it's kind of my catchphrase now, I'm not an expert, but from what I remember at the time, this killing was more of a thing American military leaders, the generals, hated Soleimani because of, you know, how many U.S. soldiers he was responsible for the deaths of. And they just, you know, were kind of frothing at the mouth to take him out. And it wasn't hard to talk Trump into doing that, because he's like, oh, you want to blow up that Arab guy? Do it. Yeah, it's awesome.
Persians are not Arabs. Iranians are not Arabs. Nonetheless, that is probably accurately what Trump said.
It doesn't matter. None of that matters.
It was also a kind of a tit for tat for the idea, because the Iranians are supplying weapons to militias in Iraq, and those militias are attacking American contractors and soldiers, as well as Iraqi contractors and soldiers. So they're like, oh, well, if you're giving them the weapons are killing our people, so we're going to kill you. Which, I mean, that's kind of, you know, war. So philosophically or not, you know, militarily, I guess it could have been a good decision, because if he's an effective leader, he was really good at it, then yeah, get rid of him. But diplomatically, yeah, I don't know that it really served it. And I don't really know that it was really that effective in reducing the weapon supplies either. But that's not really the, you know, the military's job. isn't necessarily diplomatic. So, you know, when you're asking the question, well, what did it diplomatically accomplish? I don't think the people were asked that question. What are we accomplishing diplomatically? So, like, here's a guy who's right. really good at logistics. Yeah, he's getting weapons to people that are killing our people. Let us, if you wasn't Stalin, if you got a person and you got a problem, if you don't have a person, you don't have a problem. And I don't know that the guy that replaced him, he might be just as good, though, at which point it was probably a waste of a missile, but... diplomatically, I mean, that's a different question, but diplomatically, I don't think it was that bright. As they then just yeah. they fired a bunch of missiles in retaliation that injured a lot more American soldiers, and they're claiming they're still biding their time to get revenge. So, I mean, at any point, one of our generals might be assassinated, and so I don't really know if that's the best.
So returning to Bill Burns, you know, after he, in 2014, he retired from the Foreign Service, and he took over leadership of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which was an international affairs think tank that was based in Washington, D.C. It's been around since 1910 when it was founded by Andrew Carnegie, and describes itself as being dedicated to advancing cooperation between nations and promoting active international engagement by the United States. So even after he retired from, you know, public service, he's, you know, like, he knows what he wants to do, apparently, you know, and that's work in foreign affairs. So that kind of that wraps up. We're going to do this in two parts. And so that wraps up sort of the precursor. It's his history up until he is appointed to director of the CIA. So next week, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about his appointment, and we're going to run through, you know, his methodology for running the CIA and what made him unique as the director. He's been doing things different. Mm-hmm. So in the meantime, you can follow us on our socials, twitter.com/CIA Files Podcast, instagram.com/CIA Files, facebook.com/CIA Files. And you can...
give us a review.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say, give us a review.
Yeah. Yeah. The ratings, if you like the show, give us a rating inside whatever app you're using to listen to the podcast. If you feel so inclined, you've got a little extra energy, give us a review. Tell us what you think of the show. We love to hear what you think. And what you want to hear about, you can go to our website, CIAfiles.net, to get more information on the stuff. We'll have all the links posted that are, you know, that we got information from for the story today. You can also go there and see our merchandise shop. If you want a CIA Files t-shirt or coffee mug, yeah, check it out. And yeah, we'll be back next week with the follow-up on William Joseph Burns. Wait, was it Joseph? I don't want to say, but William J. Burns. We'll go with that. All right. thanks for listening.